Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Earlier this year, a jury convicted a South Shore couple of murdering their 4-year-old daughter with a lethal combination of psychoactive drugs. The girl, Rebecca Riley, had been prescribed the drugs because she was diagnosed with bipolar and hyperactivity disorders. But the court found that her parents had abused the dosages and that an excess of medication had damaged her lungs and led to her death. Rebecca Riley's death attracted national attention. Besides calling into question the overprescribing of drugs to children, it also exposed a potentially flawed system of giving federal payments to families with disabled kids. Boston Globe reporter Patty Wen decided to examine this payment system and its role in Rebecca Riley's case. Her reporting led to a 3-part series titled The Other Welfare that's running in the Globe this week. And Patty Wen joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston, Patty.
Thank you, Sasha.
So,
happy
Patty,
to be here.
Thanks for coming on. So, Patty, briefly, I want to ask you about Rebecca Riley, because in a way, the Rebecca Riley case is sort of a microcosm of what can go very wrong when the system goes wrong. So even though there was a conviction in that case earlier this year, and in that sense, it's a closed case, can you recap for us very briefly what happened to Rebecca Riley and what her parents were convicted of having done? Because that will get us to how this ties into the series you're doing this week.
Right. Well, the way it ties into the series is really only in so much as how this family financially sustained itself. Obviously, the facts of the Rebecca Riley case are sensational, and, you know, I'm not suggesting in any form that, I mean, they're obviously very extreme. But both parents were ultimately convicted in separate trials, and they are now in prison someplace here in Massachusetts. Rebecca's obviously dead, and her two siblings are in foster care or perhaps adopted now.
And Patty, when you talk about the facts being extreme, this was a little girl who was almost catatonic, really, in terms of the kind of drugs that she was on. Is that fair
right.
to say?
She was diagnosed with ADHD and bipolar, and during the trial, it was clear the parents had a very casual approach to these medications. When they wanted their children to sleep, they would give them Clonidine. They treated these medications as almost just part of your behavioral management in families. They are obviously very extreme. They were very troubled in their own right. So they are not representative of an SSI family, but how they ultimately paid the bills, essentially, was what became the subject of my series.
And that was an incredibly startling number, and you mentioned that in your series this week. And I think the number was that this family was bringing in about $30,000 a year in federal disability payments that they received because of the disabilities that their children were labeled with having. Is that the right number, about 30 grand?
Right, but that was a combination. SSI is a program for children and adults, so they qualified, both of them, as adults. So they got payments for themselves for various sort of emotional and mental disorders, and then for their two oldest children, qualified for ADHD and bipolar. And so they got income from them, and they were in the midst of applying for Rebecca when she died. So essentially 4 out of the 5 family members before Rebecca died were on SSI.
And tell us briefly, so SSI is this federal supplemental income that goes to low-income families who have disabilities of some sort that impact their ability to find work. So originally, we're talking about sort of physical disabilities like cerebral palsy.
Right. Originally, this program, SSI, as it was first conceived, was thought of as a program for adults. And it would be adults who became disabled and needed some sort of income. And so it's kind of like welfare for adults, you could say. But they would have to prove generally, except they would have to prove they were disabled. At the very last minute, they added children. And initially, I believe the thinking was that children who were severely disabled, and this is 1972, when you're thinking of, you know, you're thinking then of cerebral palsy, Down syndrome, blindness, that parents who had such a child would have a more difficult time getting a job or keeping a job or working full time. So initially it was perceived as sort of income supplement for the parents, really.
Because the parents had kids that were so demanding in terms of the disability that they would probably have to stay home with the kids, and this money was supposed to make up for the parents not being able to work.
Right. In other words, these are not kids that at that time could maybe easily go into schools or whatever. So this was an income supplement for the parents. Possibly, too, money to help provide extra services, you know, buy a wheelchair, you know, the other extraordinary expenses that might come with disability. But that was the original thinking at that time.
And as your series described, eventually the type of disabilities that could get a family one of these payments expanded to behavioral disabilities, mental disabilities, ADHD, delayed speech.
Right. I mean, in a way, what happened, I think, is that just as society has changed, the idea of disability changed over the decades. And so it became less sort of just a physical type of disability to, you know, just the way we see it now. You see it in schools. You see it everywhere. A much broader definition of disability. That's not to say that there's anything bad about that. And there's obviously many good things about a more expansive definition of what is disability. But then that kind of comes head into, well, you have this cash assistance program now. And at what point, what type of disability should merit that payment? And then that's sort of the separate issue.
Listeners, this is Radio Boston, and I'm talking with Boston Globe reporter Patty Wen, who has a three-part series in the Globe this week about a federal disability payment system in which many payments go to families who have kids with disabilities that can include behavioral disabilities, delayed speech, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And as Patty's series wrote about, oftentimes families come to depend on this money. It becomes an incentive at times for families to label their kids disabled. And sometimes, which we'll be talking about shortly, that means that families have a large incentive to medicate their kids, because it's often being medicated that seems to help these kids qualify for disability payments. We want to know if you think that delayed speech, for example, is an appropriate diagnosis to qualify someone for a federal disability payment, or ADHD. We wonder if you think this system might encourage families to seek diagnoses for their kids. Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or maybe you have a child who does have a disability and you felt pressured yourself in some way to maybe prescribe a medication to help with that diagnosis. It's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Patty Wen, could you talk a bit, when you spoke with these families who often have kids on disability, many of them told you that they felt that medicating their kids was sort of the magic that would get their kid eligible for receiving money. Was that a constant theme?
Well, what I heard from them is the sort of dilemma I think all parents feel if they have a child with some sort of condition that where, you know, many doctors might say, well, you know, you should consider medication. I don't think any parent sort of makes a decision to do that easily. But I found in talking to these families is, not that they didn't sometimes weigh the actual clinical pros and cons. Well, maybe this will help, maybe it won't. But I think that what they also realized in some instances was that this is more word on the street. It's not that there are actually statistics to prove it, but that if your child wasn't on medication, you were definitely not getting approved. That medication became sort of like a marker for the severity of the child's mental condition. And Social Security, as much acknowledges that they certainly ask a lot of questions about medication. And among all these various behavioral learning, well, particularly behavioral or mental disorders, it is hard to figure out which kids should be approved and who shouldn't be approved. So medication is factored in there.
Patty Wen of the Boston Globe, there's another person I want to weigh in on this, and this is Mary Lou Sutters. Mary Lou is president of the Massachusetts Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children. And thanks for being here on Radio Boston, Mary Lou.
My pleasure.
You've been reading this series, I assume, and I wonder if, after reading it, or perhaps this is very well a system you already knew, if you have concerns that this federal disability payment system could have unintended consequences that could harm kids in terms of, are parents suddenly motivated to try to medicate kids who may not need that medication, or who may, maybe another type of treatment is better, and the parents might want to medicate them in order to get these federal payments?
Well, as an opening statement, I have to say that I think most parents want to do what is in the very best interest of their children. And so I think when they think of medications, it is, will that medication have a profound and positive impact on the child's functioning? I think it's very difficult for families to want to medicate their child in order to create an incentive for payment.
Do you, Patty Wen in her stories found that in some poor neighborhoods, there was very uneven application of these funds. You know, that some families were getting SSI funding when other kids with similar disabilities were not getting SSI. Do you have a sense of why that would be?
Are you talking to Mary Lou?
Patty, is this a better question for you?
Oh, I wasn't
Patty Wen,
sure.
Are you
sorry.
There? I'm sorry.
I wasn't sure who you were addressing this to.
Actually, Mary Lou, but I wonder, Patty, if maybe you're a better person to answer it. Why did you find that there might be uneven application of these funds?
I actually have no idea, because I think that, you know, realize when people apply to Social Security, I believe the approval rate is less than half. So a lot of people are not approved. But I think that's part of the puzzle that a lot of people have is to I think it is a mystery as to why some people are approved and some are not.
We have a caller from Somerville who wants to weigh in, and this is Susan calling. And Susan, your thoughts about this federal disability system that often gives payments to kids with disabilities like ADHD?
Yeah, I haven't read the piece or the upcoming pieces, but the effects of ADHD and learning disabilities on families are really not too well known. I think most people would be making judgments without knowing the stresses and some of the real problems that these children and the parents have. So, of course, there's going to be people that abuse the system, but I hope that in the pieces there's at least some data or some information that shows what good the program can also do and some success stories to sort of abate some of the ignorance we have around these issues.
Thanks for that. Mary Lou Sutters, do you want to weigh in on that?
That's a great comment. What we know is that parents who have children with emotional and mental disorders, as the primary caretakers, have tremendous stresses on the family. And if you're poor, you are coordinating all the services for your children. You're trying to get the best services that you can possibly can. And it is overwhelming. If we're going to have an SSI program for children in our nation and in Massachusetts, then it has to be for both children with both physical, cognitive, and emotional disorders.
We have a caller from Medford who has a comment also, and this is Marie. And Marie, your thoughts about this system, this federal payment system that often gives payments to families of kids with disabilities that include behavioral or speech disabilities.
I'm addressing the speech disabilities. One of my children had severely delayed speech. We were not able to get appropriate speech therapy through the schools because they looked at his educational scores, which were very high, and said, well, he doesn't qualify. Our insurance covers speech therapy, but they said, this constitutes an educational thing, so the schools should take care of it. We were paying for speech therapy out of pocket. It cost more than our mortgage. We were not able to keep it up. He is now 10. He is able to do excellent, excellent academic work in writing, but people can't understand what he's saying, and it's shutting him out of a lot of things. Like, he can write a part for a panel presentation, but he can't deliver it because people can't understand him. So something like this would be life-changing, absolutely life-changing. And if you don't get this stuff while the kids are young, it's neurologically really difficult to make changes later. So.
Marie, thank you for that. And actually, before I have one of our guests comment on that, I want to go to one more caller. This is Paul from Westwood. And Paul, you're a healthcare professional?
Yes, I'm a healthcare professional, and I see a lot of cases that, you know, should not be approved. You know, I mean, I see a lot of parents who use their kids as an instrument to get money from the state agencies or government agencies or federal government. And I really think that we should do a better job in taking the time to screen these families before approving them.
Paul, thanks for that. Patty Wen, could you comment on, when you did your reporting, how rigorous or not rigorous was the screening to make sure kids should actually be labeled this way and be getting these payments?
Well, you know, I never was sort of brought sort of behind the screen to actually see how a particular case is evaluated. Of course, I asked, but that didn't happen. And I can tell, though, but based on examining a number of talking to families and seeing the records that they've submitted, I think it differs. I think that, I mean, that's part of what is, I think, a puzzle to a lot of families. I think they submit information. Sometimes things go through very quickly. Sometimes they don't, and they have to appeal, and they have to reapply. And I get the sense, I can only go by what Social Security says that, you know, says that their standards are. And, you know, they look primarily at medical information that has priority over, let's say, what your, you know, what your teacher would say about your impairment. They look at medical information first and foremost. I don't know how it is sometimes that some people are approved and some aren't. I think that's not completely known.
Mary Lou Sutter's president of the Massachusetts Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. Cruelty to Children. I'm wondering if you want to add to that, or if you can comment on the caller's remark that some parents use their kids like instruments to sort of get payments.
Well, I'd like to two comments. As a former public official, as Patty said, the fact that the criteria does not seem to be clear, the best government programs are ones that are transparent, equitable, and fair. And it would seem to me one of the things that clearly is called out from this series, I haven't read part three yet, which is tomorrow, is that the Social Security Administration needs to really make clear what their processes are. I have to go back to the statement of parents using their children as instruments. What we know is that most parents want to do the very best for their children with the resources available to them. And poor people have very few resources available to them. And if the SSI program is a program that can help them meet the needs of their children, then we need to ensure that's the best and fairest program possible for them.
Do you consider it to be that right now, the best and fairest program?
Not based upon this series, no.
We have a caller from Sharon who wants to weigh in. This is Sharon from Danvers.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to comment firsthand. I'm in the process of applying for my son for SSI. He has ADHD, and he has an IEP at school, and he's had some problems at school. Yep. By the way, my son just came in the car. I was waiting for him. But anyways, what I wanted to say real quick was one of the caseworkers on his IEP kept pushing me to put him on meds. So I'm getting the idea from this person that's writing the article for the Boston Globe that it's the reverse of what's happening to me. And
a reverse in what way?
Well, that parents are pushing their kids to get on meds.
And in your case, it's a school pushing.
Well, in my case, the school is pushed enormously, and I'm offended by it. And I still haven't put my son on medication. And it might change his life. It might make everything better. But I just don't want to do it because he's young, and he's they wanted to put him on something that I know adults have used, Zoloft.
Sharon, thank you for that. I want to bring in one more caller. This is Phyllis calling from Andover. And Phyllis, your thoughts about this?
Yes, hi. I, too, am a parent of a child who was diagnosed when she was around 10 with high-functioning Tourette's. We have it running through the family. And she was always an excellent student, having troubles at school, which could have been, quote-unquote, emotional. I'd kind of like to remind everybody, first of all, let me tell you that we did put her very carefully on very small doses of medication, which proved to be enough. She is now halfway through her education at a large Ivy League school and doing just great and very happy, very well adjusted, and, you know, there wasn't a problem. But my main point here is I've been hearing differences applied to what you're calling, quote-unquote, mental illnesses. Mental illnesses are physical illnesses, and I believe we've had a lawsuit in this state recently which says that insurance companies can't charge you differently, your co-pays for what used to be called mental illnesses and physical illnesses. Your brain is an organ, just like your kidney, your liver, or your stomach or your heart, anything.
Phyllis, thanks for that. Before you go on, I think that Mary Lou Sutters, who's with me, again, she's the president of the Massachusetts Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children, has a comment to make related to that.
Right. And as the former state mental health commissioner, mental disorders are to be considered on the same terms and conditions as physical disorders, so that they're all considered medical disordered. And what I think we're seeing is, in fact, with the implementation of parity insurance laws in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, which is what you were referencing, is a greater or a lessening of stigma, if you would, of mental disorders. But they're not necessarily physical disorders, but we would all agree that emotional disorders and physical disorders are legitimate medical conditions.
Patty Wen, another question for you. You know, as is often the case with different types of social service support or payments, some people criticize it and they say that it encourages families to not look for work so that they won't lose their federal benefits. Did you find that evidence that might be happening in this case, that parents might not want to work in order not to lose their benefits?
Well, actually, that leads to day three, really, which I won't go into a lot of detail, but day three focuses on the teenagers. And I actually found for myself from the reporting that was one of the most sort of an aspect of this program that sort of hit me more as in the later part of my reporting, but I thought was very powerful. And their teenagers talk themselves about what it's like to be on SSI for a long time. And when you talk about disincentives to work, the disincentive is actually most extreme for the teenager himself or herself, because when they earn money, it is counted against their SSI check. So, of course, that has implications for decisions that children, teenagers make about work. I won't go into it a lot more detail.
So that's tomorrow's final day of the 3-day series.
That is part of tomorrow. And I think that gets at some of the concerns one can have. I mean, the headline of this piece is sort of unintended side effects. I think everybody agrees the program means well, totally well, and has a lot of important aspects. But I think these are unintended side effects, as I would think of them.
That was Patty Wen. She's a reporter for the Boston Globe. Tomorrow is the third day of her three-part series called The Other Welfare. It's about the growing number of kids who get federal disability payments for their families because they're diagnosed with ADHD, other types of mental disabilities. Patty, thanks very much for talking about this.
Oh, thank you.
And also with me has been Mary Lou Sutter. She's president of the Massachusetts Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children. Mary Lou, thank you very much.
My pleasure.